a fortnight ago, we considered something of great importance, namely the way in which concepts interfere with our immediate perceiving. The immediate perceiving is what we call a percept. It is happening now. We are seeing or hearing or touching or thinking or feeling right now in the living present. And the way a concept grows in our life is simply by the addition of percepts. A newborn child sees something for the first time. It sees it again and again, and soon it begins to cognize the thing. It sort of understands, yes, I've seen that before. And then later on, it's given a name. A sound, in other words, is associated with what it saw, and a concept forms in the mind of the child. So that next time it sees the same or a similar object, it recognizes the object. But by this time, the first interest has rather worn off. It doesn't give its entire attention to the object. Now, this is the sort of thing that happens to us in all through our adult life. That our concepts interfere with our percepts. Now, the realization of truth in the religious sense, the deepest and profoundest religious experiences, are in actual fact immediate percepts. They are happening right now. And what interferes with such perceiving, which in its completion, in its perfection, is actual being, that which we perceive, are our concepts. We have a concept of this, a concept of that, and it tends to interfere with the actual perceiving in the now. Therefore, we saw the importance of being free of the domination of concepts. Now, concepts are indispensable in our adult life. Because if we didn't have concepts about things and actions and events and persons and so forth, there'd be no recognition whatever. We would be seeing or hearing or thinking or touching or tasting for the very first time, just like the newborn child. Therefore, we'd be never different from the newborn child. And we can travel from birth to the grave without moving a step further forward. So concepts are necessary. What do concepts do, actually, in our adult life? They give structure to our percepts. But at the same time, they interfere with the immediate perceiving. We look at an object and say, oh yes, that's a lampstand. And we stop paying attention to it. We cease to look at this particular lampstand and see it completely in all its details and so forth. That is to say, the process of our immediate living in the now is interfered with by the concept. Now, if we are aware of that, if we are awake to that fact, and if we realize that the task of the concept is to give structure to the percept so that we know what we are looking at or listening to or touching or tasting, etc., then the percept can go on unhindered, and we can extract the essence of our perceiving and let that essence be built up into the power of intelligence. Now this is very important, especially where the holy life is concerned in its profounder aspects, and certainly it's most important as far as its profoundest aspects are concerned. What is it that prevents us from becoming free of the domination of concepts? And this is what we considered particularly last time. You remember? You too were. It is essentially the fear of death. Deep down in our souls, we are afraid to let go our concepts. We are afraid to let go our deep beliefs, our ideals, to let go what we think we have learned through long experience and so forth. But what we have learned through long experience remains with us as concepts. And if the concepts become more and more rigid and fixed, they just become dead fossils and nothing else. And they are the real barrier between the transcendent and ourselves. Now to let go of these concepts is difficult, primarily because we fear that to let these things go would be the same as death. There'd be nothing left, so to say. All our ideals would go, all our deeply cherished beliefs, our faith, our inmost fulfillments and longings and what we have discovered through great effort and whatnot, all that would go. We are afraid. We are afraid of that because we do not understand death. We do not understand that death is our great friend and ally, not an enemy to be overcome. This is one of the very unfortunate false verbal formulations which have come down through most of the scriptures of the world, to regard death as something to be overcome. What exactly? Death is an extinction of the continuity of a particular form. But the moment a particular form has fulfilled its function, if we keep it after that and cling to it, it is an obstruction to us all the time. Consider, for instance, what happens inside the body. The process of life is a continuous flow of life and the manifestation of life. And in order to maintain life, there is first the process of ingestion, followed by digestion, and then followed by assimilation and rejection. Now we all know that if the function of rejection doesn't take place in the proper way in the body, well, there is a series of illnesses which follow. And the illness can be so severe that the body would perish altogether. But this rejection is the correspondent in terms of the living process of a human body of death itself in the mind. If death did not play its proper part as the complement of birth, that which has begun and that which has proceeded in a certain way, and then if death doesn't take place completely, fully, at the right time, in the right way with respect to that, then we are mentally constipated and afterwards mentally ill and diseased. This is something we don't realize at all. We are naturally ignorant. We are naturally anxious to preserve the I, and our idea of preserving the self is to protect it against the world, against the hostile universe. This is a tremendous effort. We are part and parcel of the universal process. And if we think and act in terms of preserving the self, the particular self, against the hostile universe, we originate and perpetuate the conflict between what we commonly call the self and the mind. And that doesn't lead anywhere at all. No good comes out. Then there is another aspect. We are naturally greedy. We want to hold on to what we have discovered, what we have acquired. And we think in terms of acquisition and live and act in terms of acquisition, because we feel that whatsoever we possess is a protection, is an insurance of safety. This is natural. We think analogically from the physical, from our physical experience to our mental and spiritual life. But this sort of thing doesn't apply in the mental life at all. In fact, the acquisition of learning, of information, of knowledge, as we call it, is an obstruction to the creative activity of any intelligent mind. Because we are bound, we are attached to that which we have. We don't let that go. If we don't let that go, how will we create the new? Take, for example, what happens in music. See the history of it, see what has happened. You get the forms of music as evolved, say, by Haydn. Now, if Mozart had stuck to Haydn, he would have only repeated Haydn. And if Beethoven had stuck to that, there would have been only more Haydnish sonatas and symphonies and whatnot, wouldn't there? But they have to outgrow what they had learned. And in the outgrowing of what they have learned, it's not the power of creating through music that they cast aside, but the old forms through which the creative musical power of the previous composer expressed itself. Now it's the same with us in our mental and spiritual life. Now this is what we don't do. And we find it difficult. Because we are afraid we shall perish if we give up that which we have acquired, that which is there. We depend upon authority. Oh, but so-and-so has the great one, the teacher, the holy one of all it is, has said this, that, and the other, and this is the truth. Now, that which is said, the verbal formulation, is not the truth at all. Is a terrible thing to see, to realize. The verbal formulation is like the clothes of the person, not the living body, not the living person. When we meet somebody, we don't meet his suit or his overcoat. We meet him, the person. The suit, the overcoat is just an external something, that is all. Of not special importance. It may be important for the occasion, perhaps, to signify that he's come to a wedding or a or perhaps a funeral, as the case may be, you see. But it has no other importance whatsoever. It indicates nothing else. The person, the living person is what you want. And the truth is the living thing. The perceiving in the immediate moment is the experiencing of truth, of reality. And that is something which can never be held, which can never be kept back. We have to let the form all the time go. The mental forms which arise, the thoughts, the feelings, the ideas, the ideals, the temporal beliefs, the conclusions, everything. We must let all that go, otherwise we don't grow. We don't grow mentally or spiritually. And it's this fear of death that keeps us back, because we don't understand. But I've tried to suggest how very important death is. Death is the complement of life. And if we really understand death, we shall see death as our friend and ally. Without death continuously taking place from day to day in our life, we do not live. We merely drag on a wearisome existence because we are dragging with us the load of the past instead of being free. And this is tremendous. Now, if we realize this, we'll begin to see something else also. I mentioned a few moments ago that the seeing in the immediate present is the seeing of reality. It's in the immediate living present. And it has no relationship with any dead forms that we set up in our minds and store up in our minds. Now, what happens when a perception is taking place? The mind takes the shape, the form, of that which is being perceived. This is something which Hindu psychology has always put forward, that the mind takes the shape of the thing perceived, or the sound heard, or the perfume which is smelled, and so forth. The mind takes that shape, that form. The mind becomes that which it is perceiving. And it is that which it, that which the mind is actually perceiving and experiencing. Now the concept interferes with that. Now, supposing the concept, we don't allow the concept to interfere, but our perceiving is whole and complete. Now, supposing the mind is perceiving God, the transcendent, or whatever it is perceiving in wholeness, in completeness, then the mind becomes and is the infinite, is the truth, is the ultimate, is enlightenment, is the transcendent wisdom, love, beauty, whatever. Now it is precisely this which is the state of the mystic, talking theistically, when he is experiencing the union with God, as it is called, the unio mystica. This is precisely the state of the one in meditation who, in Buddhistic terms, enters that realm where perception and feeling in the ordinary sense have completely ceased. Or in Hindu terms, what is known as the asampranyata samadhi, where the distinction between the one who perceives, the object perceived, is completely transcended. There is only perceiving, and the separate self-sense is completely non-existent. see, this is the ultimate experiencing of transcendence, the fulfilling, which is the complete and utter fruition of humanness, in which, to use the Christian terminology, the Son of Man has become the Son of God. They are identical. Now you see how important the right use of the senses becomes. You see it, or do you not see the relationship? I'm sure you see it. You see? Because in the complete, utterly pure, perfect act of seeing or hearing or thinking or feeling, etc., you see, is the completeness, the totality, the perfection. And in this state, the rhythm of birth-death is perfect. And when the rhythm of birth-death is perfect, what we call life eternal flows unhindered. And it is realized. Afterwards, remembering the experience, one says it was utterly blissful. It was utterly perfect. There are no words to describe it. You cannot analyze it. You cannot describe it. But what is fundamentally necessary in order that such a consummation can be realized? It is necessary that the mind be utterly free of all its concepts. Now you know, this is a very deep matter. It is deep, and in a sense, it is terrible. Because here, one of the profoundest meanings of renunciation comes in. What have we got to sacrifice, to renounce? Let us approach it this way. Now listen very carefully, because this goes right into the depths. Through the ages, the great seers have naturally sought answers to certain questions. I will take this, the answers which India gave, as an example. Answering the question, what is ultimate reality? They answered, Brahma. In one word, they gave the answer, Brahma. Answering the question, what am I? Again, they gave one word as the answer, Atma. The further question arose, is Brahman different from Atma? And they said, no. Investigating that question, they found that Brahman and Atma were identical. Now it is important for us to appreciate very clearly how this investigation took place. It did not take place through logical reasoning merely. It did not take place through philosophical speculation. In other words, the activity of the discursive intellect was something which was completely transcendent. It was put aside. When the sense consciousnesses, with all their store of visual, auditory, tactile, and other images, are completely passive when all these sense consciousnesses are quite still and they don't interfere. Then the mind is unified. It is pure. It is silent. And in that silence, as one goes deeper and deeper into it, the whole sense of self-consciousness completely disappears. Till at last, there is only that which has been described in words as the universal consciousness, the absolute consciousness, the awareness which cannot be analyzed, in which there is no sense of thou, no sense of I. There is only awareness. The Buddha used the phrase vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato paham pabham. That consciousness which is attributeless, invisible, therefore, which is unending, infinite, shining everywhere. Both words have been used, paham and paham. Paham means shining, paham means accessible. That is the phrase he used. And throughout the Upanishads, you get the same sort of statement again and again. But the important thing to realize is that what is ultimately stated is that it is consciousness. Now what does this imply? That the entry into ultimate reality, or the entry into the nature, the ultimate nature of what we call the I, the self, is through the psyche. We cannot escape the psyche. And similarly, returning back to ordinary consciousness, the return is again through states of consciousness, which means the return through psyche, and now not the quiet psyche, but with the psychical activities going on. Now the implication of this is simply this, that when we come finally to the stage of verbal formulation, of thought, because it's only in thought and words that we can express in order to communicate with another this transcendent experiencing, when we come to verbal formulation, all that we are doing is expressing our mental constructs of that which was real. Only our mental constructs. Now look at Genesis, for instance. The first chapter. They say God created the world. Actually, I mean, if we set aside the mistranslations into English, the first chapter deals with the Elohim, the creative powers as they are called. The creative powers give rise to heaven and earth, and then light, and then the earth and the whales and the plants and so forth, and finally man. It ends up, the first chapter ends up with that. And the words are that the Elohim said, let there be, and they made. But does this refer to the actual physical universe as such? Does it refer to the actual whale, the actual tree? In the same way, the Upanishads declared that Brahman becomes and is this all. That is the phrase they use, this hyphen AWL, for the world. Rather a delightful way of
denoting the world.
Brahman became and is this form. And they also said that Atma became and is this form.
Now, and they give details of this all, you see, just as in Genesis. Genesis gives it in a shortened form, and the Upanishads spread it out a little more, mentioning a few more things, you see, and in slightly different ways. The way in which it is presented in Genesis is perhaps rather more artistic than the way it is presented in the Upanishads. Now, what is this all? Is it the actual world? Which is it is my mental construct of the actual world to which I am referring. When Genesis says God made the whales and the birds and the trees and man, it is not the actual thing that is referred to, but my mental construct. Because who wrote this but a man? Who said this but a man? It's my mental construct. It's very important to appreciate this. Now, why is it so important to appreciate that this creation of the world is really my own mental construct all the time? Because I'm under the illusion all through my life that I know this, that, or the other. I have discovered it by experience, or I've discovered it by investigation, by study, or I've learned about it from such and such an authority. Now, the fact of the matter is simply this. There is nothing that I know in the absolute sense. I am ignorant all along the line, from beginning to end. I see, this absolutely shatters any sort of confidence or trust or faith we may have in ourselves, doesn't it? If we see that this is true, for example, if I hold up my thumb like that, can I say that I know my thumb? Do I know it? I have an impression of it. I have a mental construct of it. I can give an ordinary physiological, anatomical description of this thumb. All right, but is that the whole story? It goes on endlessly. It never ends. And is any of my observation through my senses, through my experiments, through my mental processes, is any of it real knowledge of this thumb as it actually is? No, it isn't. We know today very definitely that all our so-called knowledge is purely our mental construct. We do not know the thing as it actually is. Science, during the last 100 years, a little less, has most conclusively shown that all that we have discovered as absolute fact, which we used to call absolute fact, is only our mental construct. We do not know what the thing in itself is. We postulate energy, matter, phenomena, the great forces of nature, the laws of nature, and so forth. They are our mental constructs only. We don't know them in the absolute sense of knowing. Now, this is very important. If I really see that I am ignorant, that the absolute truth, the ultimate truth of anything and everything is the everlasting unknown, then there is no room for conceit. And simultaneously, there is no room for any false humility. Then there is real humility. And that real humility is associated with the state of being, with being in the state of constant search. To be in the state of search and not specifically to go searching is a very, they are very different things. To be in the state of search means to remain passive, but to remain completely alert, watchful, awake, and see what we will see. To be actually searching means to predetermine, I will go and look for this. And that's no use at all, where spiritual realization is concerned. So you see, that will be an extremely important accompaniment to realizing that I do not know that I am ignorant. What we commonly call knowledge is this collection of fixed ideas, beliefs, conclusions, etc. They are hindrances all the time. So now, if all that we say that we know and we believe as regards fundamental truth, for which we use words like God or Brahman, Nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, the archangels, the angels, the spiritual world, the material world, all these phrases, they are all our mental constructs. They are illusory shapes. They are the shadows of reality. They are not reality, they are not the truth. Now this is something which is of extreme seriousness. We must look at it calmly. We must look at it not in the spirit of, I'll either prove it or disprove it. That is nonsensical altogether. One cannot prove or disprove ultimate reality. These are outside the realm of proof and disproof. Because proving and disproving takes place only in a very limited context, and if one already lays down certain premises, then you can proceed with proving or disproving. But otherwise, proving and disproving have no meaning whatsoever in the context of totality. In the context of totality, everything is included. Why is it important to realize that all the profoundest elements of what we call our deep faith, our knowledge, our realizations and so forth, are merely mental constructs which we must put aside? Why is it so important? Because if we don't put them aside, the reality will never be realized, made real. Now, what is this realization? It is a becoming, isn't it? One becomes the truth. One is the truth. Now understand Jesus' statement, I am the way, the truth, the life. I have said over and over again that transcendentally, being and awareness are identical. But this awareness is not consciousness which separates the observer and the observed. The observer and the observed are one and the same. Then there is this overriding awareness in which there is no separation. And in this overriding awareness, there is no knowing in the sense that, oh yes, I know what is happening. You don't know what is happening. You never can. Only afterwards, when we descend to earth from heaven, that we can talk about heaven. When we are in heaven, it is impossible to talk. It is impossible to know this is heaven. It is the transcendent. It is something totally other than all this which we call experience and knowledge and all the rest of it. But you see, the task which faces us is difficult, to put it mildly. A person might say, after hearing this sort of thing, but you have absolutely shattered everything for me. I haven't. Would you like your doctor to give you a bottle of perfume when you are ill, or would you like him to give the right medicine to cure the ill state? What would you like? But you see, mankind is like the person who says, no, I'd rather have a bottle of whiskey or a bottle of perfume instead of the medicine to cure the ill state. This is the truth. People are afraid to be well, to be made whole. You cannot bear the idea of giving up what they have acquired. Yes, George?
The other difficulty is that it requires self-effort.
You have to stand on your own feet. Well, of course. You have to stand on your own feet. There is no doubt about that. Now, why have I mentioned this about Genesis and about the Upanishads and about the creation of the world? Because all our thinking, feeling, our speaking, and our actions throughout the day are all very powerfully influenced by these ideas which we have. Particularly, all our morality is very powerfully influenced by these ideas. Now, if morality is influenced by ideas, we fall into the pit of attempting to acquire virtues and to overcome vices. What is a vice? What do we call, well, instead of talking abstractly, let's talk concretely. What do we call vicious conduct? Conduct whose pattern expresses its harmfulness to whatsoever is around and to the person himself. which expresses the absence of truth, the truth of truth, the absence of wisdom, the absence of love, and so forth. That is vicious conduct, isn't it? Now, we cannot change the pattern of conduct merely and convert it into a virtuous pattern. Because that which gives rise to the pattern is our living self, not the idea of a particular pattern. If the living fellow is a good fellow, his conduct, his expression, as we call it, in every way, will be just what we call virtuous. Good, noble, true, wise, loving, and so forth, won't it? Now these fundamental ideas which we have about ultimate reality, about goals which have to be attained and all the rest of it, they determine our action without our knowledge. Right deep down in the recesses of our minds, these forces are continuously at work. And since these are mere beliefs, not truth, not vital, living, creative truth, they are in constant conflict with all our frustrations, our repressions, and above all with our insatiable pleasure of life. Watch the pleasure drive. Watch the pleasure drive. Why does a person strive to be good? Because it will bring him happiness. It will bring him fulfillment. That is his argument. Superficially, intellectually, he may say, oh, no, I don't care about myself. That statement is straightforwardly a lie, an out-and-out lie. It may be a perfectly sincere lie if the person is sufficiently self-deceived as not to be able to see that he is lying. If I say that I don't care for myself, I live for my God. Good God, how can I live for the God whom I have never seen or know nor understand? What am I talking about? It's like the tramp in the street who signs a check for £1 million and gives it to some charity. It's as absurd as that, isn't it? I can give that which I have to give, that which is here with me to give. If it isn't here, I can't give it. I'm just fooling myself and trying to fool other people. But these beliefs, these fundamental ideas which we have, we must look into them in order that we may be completely free of them, that we truly renounce the whole lot. Because all these mental constructs are illusory shapes. They are ghosts, they are shadows. They, mentally and spiritually, they are like ghouls who eat away our mental and spiritual being. Now you can see how all the parsons of the world and all the priests would like to take brickbats and practice throwing them accurately at the right person's head. But isn't this true? Look into it. Look at it. Don't accept it or believe it because I say it. Don't say it is worth considering merely because I've said it, or anybody else has said it. You look into it, just examine it. See, just be watchful all the time. Be watchful and see if this isn't the case. You see, the Inquisition and its terrible horrors, the great religious wars of history, have taken place in the name of nothing else but God. How and why? The most awful cruelties, the most ungodly, the most devilish things have been done in the name and with the sincere belief that they were serving their God. Mental construct. That God was a mental construct, wasn't it? It was God in the image of man. In the image of my stupidity, my ignorance, my devilish hate, resentment, ill will, anger, jealousy, frustration, greed, and all the rest of it. Isn't that the case? Well now, look into it. Now there's another approach to it all. You know how in Buddhism the analysis of man, as the Buddha taught it, is related to what are called the wisdom meditations in this manner. Here is the body, the external shape. You see it just as the body. And you go on with right wisdom, you see that it is impermanent. That it is a source of misery and pain. That it is a source of pleasure which is temporal and which always ends in disappointment and the passion to repeat the pleasure and so the wearing away of your life energies. In mere gratification. So that whether it is a source of temporal pleasure or direct pain and misery, it is ultimately painful, it is aging, it is decaying, it is dying. So it is impermanent, it is the source of sorrow, and it is not the reality. Anatta, as they say. It is not the ultimate reality. Therefore, don't grasp. Don't cling to it. Use it in the right way whilst we live, but don't cling to it. Don't value it in the wrong way. Value it in the right way, namely, recognizing the fact that unless there was the living person, there could be no realization possible. Minus this physical brain, there is no such thing as any sort of realization. None at all. This is an important fact. All right, so we don't grasp that. Now the same with regard to the field. And the feelings comprise are purely physical sensations through the nervous system, our emotions, and our psychical sensitivities, our feelings, as we say, by which we know this, that, or the other. Those also arise, they pass away, they are impermanent. They too are a source of sorrow, of pain, frustrations, lack of fulfillment, actual pain, all that is felt, and so forth and so forth. And they are not, I'll just use the simple English word, God. Therefore, don't grasp that feeling. Then we come to those two very important aspects which make up our personality. Sanya and Sankhara, the perceptions and the mental constructs. One of the deep meanings of Sankhara is the mental construct, that which is put together, the confecting, a confection of ideas and so forth, you see, Sankhara. They too are impermanent. They arise, they die. They are sources of sorrow. Why? Because they impel us to all kinds of activities which are fruitless, which do not bring realization. We considered a few moments ago how wars had arisen in the name of God, in the name of religion as well. They do not conduce to fulfillment, to true happiness, to peace. Therefore, do not grasp, let them go. And consciousness itself also, do not grasp, let it go. You see the place of death? Now look, in the ordinary process of our life, and the word ordinary in this case includes the extraordinary too. In our life process, physical actions and processes, feelings, ideas, mental constructs, and consciousness, whether we are seeing or hearing or touching or thinking or whatever it is, all these arise, don't they? So the teaching is, let it all go. It arises, all right, pay attention to it, pay complete attention to it. Let its essence be built into the living power of intelligence to see the truth in the immediate moment. That is the purpose of it. And then let the forms all go. Let the state of consciousness go. Don't cling to it. Supposing we go to a concert and it's a wonderful performance and our consciousness is just lifted out of this world, we say wrapped beyond the senses, into union with something eternal and wonderful and all the rest of it. And then we cling to it. Now, I want to keep that whilst I'm in the bus or the car going home. I want to keep that whilst I'm cooking my supper or making coffee for my friend who took me to the concert and so forth. You can't. Let it go. It's finished. Done with. Let it go. This is the death part of it, the letting it go. But we don't do that. We cling. We want to keep on to all the dear corpses. This is of my 47th ancestor, William the Conqueror. Used, you know, when he used to smoke his pipe. So I cling to that. One is always reminded of Puck's remark, Lord, what fools these mortals be. Mortality and folly always go together. So let it go. Let death play its proper part. Now what happens when we do let death play its proper part with respect to everything? Birth and death, if the rhythm is perfect, there comes a null point. The emptiness, the silence, it is in that silence that complete creative renewal takes place. But if we don't let death play its part fully and completely, and we cling on to something, that something obstructs this luminous, empty moment, and the creative renewal does not take place. The result is that the mind becomes duller and duller. The mind becomes depressed. We lose our youth. The true youth which we can have is this youth. And this is the meaning of Brahma Sanankumara. Brahma, the Father God who creates, the Creator, who is the ever virgin youth. Sanankumara, ever virgin youth. Because there is creative renewal. And this is one of the significances of the teaching of God the Father. But keep it as an idea, as a mental construct. God the Father, some mysterious fellow up there, you see, who does this, that, and the other for me and answers my prayers, and you're finished. So, we must let death play its part fully and completely. Now, we must let death play its part fully and completely in relation to all religious teachings. To everything that has been put out by the mind of man. Why? The form, the religious teaching has come down only in terms of forms. Not the immediate living truth of the moment, which is something which you and I individually have to experience from moment to moment. What has come down, our heritage, is only a collection of forms. They are fossils. They are mental constructs. They are concepts. Now, if we recognize that all the teachings, our tremendous spiritual heritage as we call it, and which we venerate, partly rightly and largely wrongly because we are ignorant. Not that the heritage is bad. The heritage is all right. But it is I who am foolish, and therefore do not know how to venerate it in the right way. See? Now, this which has come down, if I recognize that, yes, these are concepts, these are mental constructs, and if I let them act only insofar as they will inspire me, induce me, if you like, to remain awake, watchful, in the immediate now, the living now, so that my perceiving will become so complete and so perfect that I perceive reality as it is, perceive the infinite, perceive God, perceive that transcendence, then I have fulfilled that for which I was born. Sophia, the perceiving of truth, of the transcendence, of infinity, etc., cannot take place as an objective perceiving by a subject, oneself. That is, oneself. You see, it cannot take place that way. What I do watch is that which obstructs the perceiving. And in the complete awareness of watching what is obstructing, the obstruction which may be compared to a thick cloud, a fog, just suddenly vanishes away, and the clear light of day is there. The eternal light is there. This is how it happens, how it actually happens. This is what we do.
But one of the most difficult parts involved in all that I've tried to put forward today is this. We cling to our beliefs, our religious beliefs. We have our doctrines. For example, if you take the East, all the doctrines about karma and rebirth and the path and the steps of the way and all the rest of it. It's an awful load. Drop the load. Drop the load. That is to say, the mental constructs in relation to it. And if that load is dropped and the obstructing mental constructs are out, then you will see the actual living operation of that to which we have given names like karma, samsara, and nirvana, and so forth and so forth. You see the point? I'm not saying that the teachings are false, nor am I saying that the teachings are true. Truth in the religious context is the realization by the living being. Heaven, nirvana, the kingdom of God, fulfillment, realization, call it what you like. It is you, the living being, who are living in that way in the immediate now. That is the thing. And for that, one has to be free of all the obstructions, which include all mental constructs, all teachings, all acquisitions, and so forth. This is renunciation of the problem. By renouncing everything, you realize God. This is the meaning of renouncing everything. And it's very difficult. I saw this very clearly, very, very clearly, just Monday before last. After all these years, the whole thing just completely cleared up. You see, I have not destroyed anything at all. I haven't taken away anybody's faith, but I've tried to show how that faith can come to real life instead of this imaginary picture in the distance. It's a case of learning and becoming able to see and know the living reality and distinguishing that living reality from all its shadows.
Yes,
in the cave.
Where
all people were sitting there could see where the shadows were doing anything. Well, you had something terrible today. You will find that if you really see this, the whole of the wonder, the beauty, the immensity, the power, the glory, whatever it is, which has been written about in wonderful poetic forms through the ages, is all true. And you will always live then
every moment will become a living in that beatitude. I'm using the word beatitude deliberately, not ecstasy. Ecstasy is where you are beside yourself. You are not beside yourself. You are completely yourself because all self has gone out and the whole of reality shines through you unhindered. This is the mark. When there is peace and strength, there is real comfort. Comfort in the sense in which we considered it some months ago, you remember? Inside you. And you will really naturally stand on your own feet. You'll have no difficulty. You won't need